I'm Gary Nolan. I'd like to welcome you to a continuation of our series on spirituality. Today, Andrew Harvey from the Ozark Mountains. Andrew Harvey is an internationally renowned religious scholar, writer, teacher, and author of over 30 books. He is the founder of the Institute of Sacred Activism, an international organization dedicated to inspiring people to become more involved in challenging our global crisis and to commit themselves to peace and sustainability. Andrew was born in India, studied at Oxford University, where he was a fellow of the All Souls College, and has taught at Oxford, Cornell University, California Institute of Integral Studies, and other institutions over the years. He is perhaps best known for having explored all the different religions in depth, particularly Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, and Sufism, and interpreting them in a passionate manner that preserves their meaning and significance for our time. He received many awards for his writings, including the Benjamin Franklin Award. His most recent book is Radical Passion, Sacred Love, and Wisdom in Action. Before that, The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, which won the Nautilus Silver Award for Social Change. Welcome to our program, Andrew.
Gary, thank you so much, and thank you so much for doing this program on spirituality, because we all know the crisis is very extreme, and so many people are paralyzed and in denial, and I think more and more of us are waking up to the necessity of acting, but acting from a sacred consciousness, which can only be sustained by a deep spirituality and deep spiritual practice. So thank you.
I just had the opportunity to interview a person for a documentary I was doing. The individual is Dr. Christopher Baer. He is a psychologist to the best known Wall Street individuals. For 30 years, he has given counsel to CEOs, venture capitalists, hedge fund executives, traders, Wall Street lawyers, and their families. And he is intimately aware of the self-destructive and devastating psychological damage caused from being immersed in the high financial culture.
Yes.
But then he says, Gary, there is really no difference between the presidents of the United States and those that support them in their inner circle, the heads of major Wall Street firms, the heads of the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, the heads of the federal agencies. He said, what you're looking at is you're looking at a group of people who are always exceeding what they should do to create happiness and joy in their life. Their solutions are never the right solutions. And he gave an example. He said, look at the best and brightest. The best and brightest was John F. Kennedy and his brother.
Yes.
But initially, before he was martyred and before his brother had epiphany and changed and became more populist, they plotted people's assassination. Fidel Castro, the Diem brothers in Vietnam.
Yes.
They had a chance to get us not in Vietnam. They took us deep into Vietnam.
Yes.
And they were rogues on every level, but they were wrong. McNamara and McMundy and Westmoreland, the best generals, the best legislators, were all wrong about Vietnam. Then we had the Ivy League group, the best and brightest, with George Bush and his group.
What happened? Yes.
And they were wrong also.
Yes.
And then we were wrong about Libya, and we were wrong about Iraq
and Afghanistan. We've been wrong about everything.
But these are the best and brightest, and he says that we as a society rarely hold people who are narcissists and sociopaths to any standard that we would hold ourselves. And he made this comment. He said, if the average person was to have made the mistakes and have caused the death and destruction and suffering, we as a society would have not allowed them to walk away without challenging them on the lack of moral integrity. And
right.
Yet, with all the people in power, we do not remove them from power. They never remove themselves from power. And he said, at the very least, people who have been consistently wrong should have the temerity and the humility to say, I made a mistake. All of us made a mistake. My counselors made a mistake. The vice president, Cheney, made a mistake. And Paul Wolfowitz made a mistake. Richard Pearl made a mistake. And we're now saying goodbye. and we're going to go work on a farm somewhere for repentance. Never do we say we're sorry. People in the media don't say they're sorry. The Bill O'Reillys and others. So would you give us your input upon the people who should guide us, the people who should be examples of a spiritual awakening and making decisions from a spiritual enlightened place that benefit all and harm none, are almost never the people that we select?
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think even more alarming, if possible, than the corruption and the unbelievable lack of sacred or spiritual responsibility of those in power on every level is the massive apathy and paralysis of the populace. After all, America has sat and watched the fiasco in Iraq and Afghanistan and not held its leaders to account. America has sat and watched the Supreme Court give the whole Constitution away to the corporations so that American democracy has become the best of democracy that money can buy and done nothing. America has sat and watched appalling energy policies be continued at a moment when the entire future of the climate is at stake and America is the chief polluter of the world and done nothing. So there is not only the problem of a massive corruption at all the levels of power, of the media, of corporations, of government, but it's answered by and sustained by a horrific apathy and paralysis and abandonment of citizenship and its rights. What is needed is a revolution of love and wisdom in action. And that love and wisdom has to transcend all liberal intellectual categories, and it has to be fueled by deep spiritual insight. What's also needed is that we need to admire not the people who succeed in a self-destructive, suicidal, and matricidal success machine, those who are turning up, and there are hundreds of thousands of them all over the world, turning up in this tremendous crisis to devote their lives to sacred activism, the marriage of deep spirituality with radical action. I think that there are people on the world scene who exemplify this, and then there are people in all kinds of realms in America and all around the world who, extraordinary, ordinary people who have had it with the system of cold evil that is now threatening the possibility of human future, and are turning up, devoting their whole energies to doing quite extraordinary things. On the world scene, I think we have quite amazing examples of the kinds of enlightened leaders we need. We have had Mandela, who, after an initially very unawake, violent opposition to apartheid, which one can understand but which would never have allowed for any kind of smooth transition, went through his own dark night of the soul and came out of it a hero of compassion and intelligence, and enabled a very difficult transition from the horror of apartheid to the confusion of modern South Africa to take place. We've had Lech Walesa, who was able to bring together all of the outrage of the Polish people, but focus it through a non-violent movement, which eventually unseated the Russians, a non-violent movement dedicated, incidentally, to the Black Madonna. We have the example of Aung San Suu Kyi, who is leading quite obviously from a very high place of realized truth and presence. And we have, of course, to my mind, the most extraordinary enlightened leader on the planet, the Dalai Lama, someone who has for 50 years been in the center of an exploding genocide, largely ignored by the world that celebrates him as the greatest living teacher, but has nevertheless continued to not only speak out of the depths of his tradition and teach out of his tradition, but to exemplify telling truth to power in a way that, if there was a hope that power would listen, it could listen, and exemplifies the marriage of profound spirituality and commitment to environmental, social, psychological, spiritual transformation. Jane Goodall is another figure that I think exemplifies what I'm talking about. Jane is a woman in her late to middle 70s, she spends at least 300 days of her life every year on the road. She's created roots and shoots. And in her very presence, which is on the one hand fired by extreme pain and heartbreak at what's being done to the animals, but also radiates hope and pragmatic solutions for anybody who is willing to listen, in Jane's presence you feel what an enlightened leader could be. And there are many at lesser levels in power who exemplify this. These are the people we should be turning to. These are the people we should be listening to. These are the truly successful people at the highest level. What I want to say, too, is that I, in my life, encounter, as I travel all over the world, trying to get the vision of sacred activism that's been entrusted to me across, I meet absolutely amazing people who are turning up with very few resources, getting together with others, and doing very grueling work against great odds with deep peace, profound persistence, and real rugged hope. Not a hope based on immediate results, but a hope based on the knowledge that only being grounded in spiritual depth and grounded in a vision of human possibility can give you the stamina to go forward. I'm thinking of three people at the moment as I'm speaking to you. I'm thinking of a man called Adam Bucko, who is 36, who founded a few years ago the Reciprocity Foundation for Homeless Kids in New York. This is a man who could be earning $300,000 a year. He's handsome, he's charismatic, he's brilliant. What has happened to him is that his heart has been shattered open by the pain of the poor, and he has devoted his life to creating what is one of the most adventurous and forward-looking and creative foundations for helping homeless kids restore their lives and take their place in this revolution of love and action. He was about to go into a monastery in the Himalayas and was walking down the streets of Delhi, and a ragged, shattered, starving child came up and took his hand. And at the moment that that child took his hand, an electric shock went through his body and his heart broke open, and he realized that he was narcissistic in wanting to separate himself from the world and that he had to plunge into the world. He then lived in an ashram in the middle of the Delhi slums where poor people were dying of AIDS in the most horrific way, and he tended them. And when he came back to the States, he walked the streets of Orlando talking to homeless children, trying to help them, and then founded Reciprocity with no money, no resources, but a vast heart and a strategic mind. He's been able to accomplish a great deal. He's just written a great book, Occupy Spirituality, and he's starting a movement to mobilize and galvanize young people called HUB. He's one of the enlightened leaders. I'm thinking of a woman called Hamati, who I met when I was last in India, and she is a woman who woke up to the terrible plight of prostitutes in the slums of Bombay. Indian society is very conservative, but of course, like all societies, has an enormous lust underbelly, and prostitutes are considered truly disgusting, lowest form of life. They often come from the untouchable classes. And, of course, there's no medical treatment and no safeguards for them, so very often, at a very early age, they get AIDS and die. And she was appalled by the situation. She didn't have any money. She didn't have any fancy connections. What she did was to get together other women like her who had great compassion on these women and start an organization that helps women in prostitution learn skills so that they can get out of prostitution and start being able to feed their children and their families in ways that doesn't put their health and their whole livelihood and their whole world at risk. She's an enlightened leader. I'm thinking of a woman, too, called Cilla Elworthy. Cilla has been nominated for the Nobel 3 times. She started a whole movement. equivalent of nuclear disarmament around her kitchen, because she had an idea which flashed into her mind in a tram in Brooklyn, actually. And the idea was, how can we possibly disarm nuclear weapons until we know who makes the decisions and why they make the decisions and how the decisions are made and who actually implements them? So round her kitchen table, she assembled three other adventurers, and together over about 15 years, they collected the names of all the people in England and in China and in America who actually deal with the nitty-gritty of the decisions around nuclear weapons. And she brought into the same room people who made the decisions for the nuclear industry and those who truly, truly wanted to warn them of the enormous dangers. Out of these discussions, several very extraordinary things came, several great shifts came. But again, she didn't wait to have money or connections. She started around her kitchen table because she was passionate about the future of the planet, because she was grounded in sacred practice, and because she really, really knew that if she didn't start it, it wouldn't happen. So she began, and over time it had an enormous effect. Then she began the... She worked to begin the elders, the group of people which Mandela got together to be elders, enlightened leaders, men like Desmond Tutu, women like Margaret Robinson. And they have done some wonderful work. And then she founded Peace Direct, which works with people in areas of a hot conflict, terrible conflict, to give them the tools, the resources of nonviolent communication and spiritual practice of a simple kind to be able to lead their societies out of horror into the beginnings of order. What characterizes all these three people are three things. Heartbreak at the agony and suffering of this potentially terminal crisis. Secondly, a great commitment to inner work, because all of them know that they cannot do their work in such a violent and crazy world unless they are absolutely grounded in a living experience of the spirit. Not a faith that assumes that God exists, but a living experience through prayer and meditation of the spirit living in them and as them. And thirdly, what characterizes these three people is that they did not wait for others to join them to create something. They followed their heartbreak and grounded their spirit in the divine and just rolled up their sleeves and started to enact the pragmatic visionary solutions that they were guided to. These are the people we should be celebrating. These are the people whom the young should be taught about in universities. This is the kind of true success that should be lauded in our culture. And the media should be devoting its time not to Kardashian reality shows and the monstrous diversions and distractions which keep the world comatose, but to the careful reporting of how extraordinary, ordinary people, galvanized by heartbreak, grounded in spirituality, can effect quite extraordinary change even in impossible situations, because it's these people who are guiding us out, if only we can follow them, out of the pit of destruction that we have dug ourselves into.
Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate those insights. More and more today, we're finding people disempowered by the fears that surround them from mainstream media and the government and people in power and large corporations, even the banks. They are fearful of being enslaved to debt. A very common way to put aside our fears is to escape in entertainment that you just mentioned, like the Kardashians.
And addiction and obesity, etc.
And superficial activities just to feel better. And several decades ago, people would seek out spirituality and meditation and yoga as an alternative to the lifestyles of our society and parents. And we followed that course. What has been the consequence of this, the blowback, and then what would be your definition of self-empowerment today as compared to the way it was understood in the past, especially since we've had so many, but well, how can I say this somewhat sensitively, the commercial spiritual movement, the New Age movement.
Oh, God, you can say it as loudly as you want. I hate that movement. Mm-hmm. Let's get absolutely clear. The New Age has been a massive narcissistic orgy of self-referential spirituality, which is not spirituality at all. It has been, I believe, fundamentally corporate-sponsored and is totally inoffensive to the powers that be, because all it stresses is personal liberation, personal fulfillment, and its vision of God is as a kind of cosmic ATM that you just put your request into, and suddenly you get a Maserati and a McMansion and the Cuban houseboy thrown in. To me, this is Babylonic desolation, not a real path. And unfortunately, this fake mysticism, which is nothing to do with the authentic path of love, has contaminated millions of people. So it's almost impossible for a teacher like myself and other teachers like myself who want to rouse people to the extremity of the crisis to do so, because they produce New Age platitudes like, we cannot be afraid, we just increase the desolation by looking at it, which is like saying you don't want to hear that you have leukemia from the doctor, but just be told you have a common cold, which is, of course, absolute psychotic insanity in the face of the insanity that we're living. So the New Age has been another factor in our disaster and not a solution to it. But all through these last calamitous years of corporate-sponsored spirituality, there has been the arising of a group of teachers who know that the world is in terrible shape, and who also know that there is enormous help for people in the authentic mystical paths and in the authentic mystical practices. And these include people like Matthew Fox, who has been a tireless advocate for cosmic Christ consciousness, the living Christ in action. People at times like Marianne Williamson, who has been very fierce in her denunciation of the systems of cold evil and is now standing for office herself against great opposition and with great courage. And a host of lesser known but extremely humble and skilled teachers who really have been trying against enormous odds to transmit the reality of the true path, which demands a death into selflessness and the service that flows from it, and to propagating the kinds of practices that can truly help people in a time like this. And I hope that I'm one of them, because if I wasn't, I would shoot myself. So there has been a hidden movement, which I feel now is gaining enormous traction. I've just started a sacred activism series for North Atlantic Books, which has Random House distribution. This would not have been possible 5 years ago. And in this series, we're publishing books that deal with all the major problems from a sacred activist perspective, from an unflinching look at the crisis and a recognition that the solutions that are necessary cannot be from the consciousness that's created the problem and have to come from a much more inspired and illumined awareness. And they include all kinds of experts on the environment, on animal rights, people like Monica Sharma, who worked in the UN at a very high level and understood from her very depressing experience there the need for systems change, and also understood the need for spiritually awake people to do that systems change, and is writing a great book on that. And that gives me hope. I think that although corporate-sponsored spirituality has had such a massive takeover in the marketplace, there have always been people, and they're growing, who understand that this is just selling them a mess of radioactively stinking garbage pottage. Nothing real, and certainly nothing that can sustain people through what will either be a terrifying evolutionary period that leads to new order, or potentially even near-term extinction. We're looking at either millions and millions, or perhaps billions of people dying and some remaining, or everybody going and a large part of nature going if the methane gases in the Arctic, for example, are completely released. We need a spirituality strong enough, grounded enough, passionate enough to be able to sustain people through the greatest evolutionary transformation humanity has ever known. My life's been dedicated to finding the practices and to finding the true path so that I could try, with all my follies and flaws, to represent that to people and inspire people. The Dalai Lama is doing that, of course, on a global scale. But now it's time for millions of people to awaken to the necessity of fusing a profound, simple spiritual practice that can initiate them into the depths of their divine consciousness and radical, wise action informed by that consciousness. I don't know if this call for sacred action will be answered, but I know that it's the only game in town, that nothing else can get us through. And I'm very relieved when people of intellectual grandeur and ferocity of Chris Hedges also points this out, because I know that Chris understands the crisis from a visceral level, is appalled by where we are, but has kept alive the hope that human dignity at least can be saved if people really ground their being in God and go forward in service and rebellion.
Andrew, I believe that part of our error has been where we have looked for our truths and the individuals that we have acted towards, supported with our money, our devotion, to give us the truth. When you look at the left, the corporate left, when you look at the corporate right, you see charismatic people who make promises, none of which are based upon spiritual awareness. If there were, then we wouldn't have homeless people. We wouldn't have 60 cities in the United States making it a crime with punishment up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine for allowing a homeless person to sleep in their own car.
God.
We would not, in Orlando, Florida, for example, you're not allowed to feed a homeless person, even if you've been doing so as a church. You're not allowed, for example, in North Carolina, in one town, where they open their doors to, on a frigid night, well below zero, to allow some homeless people to come in and sleep on the pews. They were told, you can't do this anymore.
In Jesus' house.
Yes, but that is what is happening because of the what I call the Oprah culture.
Now,
I remember once when...
She bears a lot of responsibility for this, because when she could have had on real teachers teaching real stuff and galvanizing real solutions, she had on people who were peddling New Age popcorn and made them into celebrities. This was a fatal mistake, and it's cost the culture very dear, I think.
Yeah, like The Secret, for example.
Yes.
And also when I saw that Deepak was charging thousands of dollars to have, I think at the time it was, this is years ago, Demi Moore do some meditation with him at the ocean, suddenly everybody who was famous in Hollywood, or a lot of them, wanted to pay the $1,000 to go and meditate with Deepak. And I thought at the time, why didn't they ask the Dalai Lama what should it cost to meditate with a true teacher? So I'm what I believe is part of our problem, part of it,
yes,
is that
we've been given people of the second rank to worship, while the first rank has been absolutely under-supported. Nobody gives any money to the people who are doing the real work, while fake teachers and fake sacred activists get the cash because they know how to play the system. This is appalling.
But our whole culture today has then taken under its wing those people who come with simple solutions.
Right.
That are all based upon the selfishness of the individual. You don't want to feel your pain. You don't want to feel your anxiety. Well, just do this mantra or read my book or here's. And in the end, we never say, okay, let's go back and look at all that you've done, all your books or videos or your appearance on television. How many people have actually changed? How many people can say because of your message they were able to fundamentally change their life?
Well, they can't fundamentally change their lives from a spirituality like that, because it doesn't challenge the very premise of your life, your ego, and your commitment to your own comfort while the world's burning. Authentic spirituality is an outrage to the ego, and this culture is entirely about cosseting, comforting, pampering, extolling, celebrating, and rewarding the most narcissistic aspects of the ego.
Yeah, these are all people who, when you look at their own lifestyles, the people who are providing the forums, they're all living, you know,
they're living
material
on the hog. They're living as multimillionaires.
Yes.
They're living in splendor. They're collaborating with other superstars in the superstar system. And this is massively corrupt, I think, and very dangerous. And it's even more dangerous because the media couldn't care less about spirituality. When it has to do something about spirituality, immediately gravitates to the stars at hand rather than look for the teachers with the real message who can really help.
We seem to have embarked on a cultural path in this country that is leading towards various forms of destruction, the destruction of our educational system, to really teach students, to empower them how to think critically. We have our own approach to having politicized our educational process, our health process, our
yes.
environmental process. So the people who are controlling these movements all benefit from it, and nothing is transformative. Everything is merely lightweight, adaptive, but nothing that stops the environment from going to critical levels, stops the decimation of our natural resources, stops the pollution of our bodies or our body politic. And so when you see the people...
Well, you can't have a movement that wants to stop those things if you're peddling a vision of private liberation and telling people that spirituality is about all about you. How can you have a movement that addresses systemic evil and foments a calm, peaceful, nonviolent, but very forceful rebellion against the systems of cold evil if you have a spirituality in place which doesn't for one moment address the terrible systemic evils and doesn't call for service, radical, passionate, selfless service? This is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a culture of narcissism on every level. And it's actually now fermenting insanity. I would say that it's not simply destructiveness we're going towards. We've been on that path for a long time, destroying the animals, destroying the environment, but we're actually going mad. And Chris says it so well when he says, when civilizations start to die, they go insane. Let the ice sheets in the Arctic melt. Let the temperatures rise. Let the air, soil, and water be poisoned. Let the forests die. Let the seas be emptied of life. Let one useless war after another be waged. Let the masses be thrust into extreme poverty and left without jobs, while the elites, drunk on hedonism, accumulate vast fortunes through exploitation, speculation, fraud, and theft. That's beyond destructiveness. It's psychosis. And that's the really terrifying danger of our time, that we're in a culture that's not just drunk on destructiveness, but actually going insane through that drunkenness and wheeling out of any possible reach by reality.
We're at the threshold today, Andrew, of where our sense of life and the planet's sacredness is being lost.
Yes.
It is for this reason our civilization has been abusing the environment, raping the ecology that you just mentioned with Chris Hedges' insights, and exploiting the resources. And consequently, we've forgotten what it means to be an authentic human being.
Totally.
So what are the greatest challenges people face today in their spiritual lives, particularly among the youth, in order to regain their spiritual authenticity? And then please take us through some of the steps or stages for people to use as a guideline to reconnect with the sacredness of life.
The first thing that I believe everyone who is truly concerned should do is to start connecting with the source, with the spirit, with the divine, by whatever name they choose. There are so many ways now available to people, because all of the treasures of the mystical systems have been unveiled to us in the last 30 years, and then all the great practices too have been shared with us through wonderful places like Sounds True, which has made available major teachings, major teachers, transmissions in ways that can be available to everybody. It's essential that people realize that the divine is real and that you can connect with it directly, but that you have to do some simple, humble, rugged work. You have to get on your knees, you have to start meditating, and you have to start longing for union with the one that is the real. When you do that, you also need to identify what it is that you most deeply care about, what breaks your heart so deeply that you're prepared to actually step out and do something about it. You need to realize that if you're going to go on a spiritual journey, it's connected to justice, to balancing the terrible systems that are now destroying everything, to creating in you a strength that will enable you to tell truth to power and start organizing ways of unseating this craziness before it destroys everything. The third thing that people really need to understand and become very clear about is that you cannot do this. You cannot do sacred activism, because what I'm describing is sacred activism, unless you do it in community, in a group of people. And that's why I've started what I call networks of grace, because I had a sudden illumination studying Al-Qaeda and the right-wing organizations that liberals and sweethearted mystics have been pitifully underorganized and cannot have any force in the culture or in the world unless they come together and start doing the rugged work of creating community and working as a community against the problems that are out there and for solutions. Networks of grace are between 6 to 15 people in a local setting who meet together, pray together, eat together, celebrate together, build bonds of sacred friendship together, and then choose a cause in that community that they pool all of their connections and resources towards and hold each other accountable for acting in the community to solve and to put forward radical solutions. These are now all over the planet, and these for me represent the hope, because I have no hope of any top-down change now. I don't think the politicians are going to change. I don't think the CEOs have any interest in changing. And I think that if we leave it up to any kind of so-called expert, we might as well just slit our throats and lie down to die in the street. The revolution of love in action will be a grassroots revolution. So it means people everywhere doing what I've said, connecting with source, doing the practices that can sustain that connection, realizing that that connection is to make you strong enough to stand up for justice, and then organizing yourself with other people in what I've called networks of grace to start manifesting real power of selfless service. I can't see any other solution, and this to me is a possible way through whatever it is that we're called to face. But it's just, when I talk like this out there, and I talk like this all over the world, it's America that I find the hardest place to in any way enthuse and inspire, because the habits of individualism and the habits of private narcissism in spirituality and the habits of having to succeed in this ghastly rat race have been so ingrained and so ingrained as reality in the American psyche that it's extremely hard to get Americans to truly understand that they're in a dying civilization, that they've created an empire which is amongst the worst empires the world's ever seen and the most destructive, and that they have a responsibility to wake up and start doing something real to end and unravel the systems that have kept them so comfortable. America is a very hard nut to crack spiritually. I'm sure you find that also. That yes. This is the belly of the beast. There are amazing people doing very radical and extraordinary things, such as yourself and Chris Hedges, whom I admire so much, and others like Guy McPherson, who is telling the truth about climate change, and Carolyn Baker doing her incredible work. Her great book, Collapsing Consciously, should be read by everybody. There's a great deal of great work out there, but still the numbers of people who are willing to climb out of denial, willing to forfeit their comfort, willing to see exactly where we are minimal.
I'd like you to speak on the relationship between our emotional states and the characteristics and the basic principles of sustainability and resilience. For example, can you show the relationship between our need to learn to sensitize ourselves to the gift of empathy and or compassion in order to create a sustainable future?
Unless we wake up to the reality of the universe, that it is an interconnected, intercommuning universe in which every single thing is related to everything else. And this is not only the truth of the mystical systems, but it's also the truth being revealed by quantum physics. Unless we wake up to that, not just intellectually, but emotionally and viscerally, and put that awakening into action, we're finished. So what is essential, I think, for anyone who wants to take the path that is realistic for this time, is to cultivate compassion. Compassion isn't just an emotion. Compassion is a living force of wisdom inside the psyche. And what I've learned from my own initiations into the different mystical systems, especially from the Mahayana Buddhist system, which is, of course, the Dalai Lama system, and from the Christ mystics, the great mystic man who was my father, Father Bede Griffiths, exemplified this, is that when you find that compassion for others, for animals, is awakening in your heart, it's not just enough to feel it. You need to keep it strong, keep it awake. And the only way you can do that is through sacred practice, heart practice, practice of such sublime practices as Tonglen in Tibetan Buddhism, in which you imagine yourself breathing in the pain of yourself or of another person or of a whole group of people or even of the world, and breathing out great compassion and healing. So what's needed is first the realization that the universe is an interconnected intercommunion of sacred relationship. Turning up in that relationship, feeling the beauty and the pain of that relationship, because once you awaken to the reality of reality, that everything is sacred, everything holy, every animal, every tree, every stone, every being, you also awaken to the absolute nightmare of what we in our ignorance and in our passion for power have created. So you have to be able to bear the heartbreak of that, which you can only do by being grounded in divine consciousness. Then you have to make the commitment to do the practices that will sustain that perception and give you the strength to love in that interconnected way and bear the pain of that love and stand up and stand out and tell truth to power and start acting. If you can do those things, and the mystical traditions are really the inner sciences of how to do those things, if you can do those things and allow the divine to help you into a wholly new level of energy and passion and peace and power, then you can turn up in a time like this and radiate calm and purpose, come what may, but only then.
How can the manner in which we deal with our relationships with lovers, family, friends, community, serve as a catalyst for bringing greater harmony that you just mentioned into our lives and the lives of others? And can you speak a little bit about how we enter the sustained relationships to be a part of our spiritual growth and evolution?
I think that sacred relationship is the truth of the universe, so it's the truth of our lives from the bottom up. I think as you start to awaken to love as the supreme power and creatrix of the universe, and love's expression as this total web of interconnection, you start to begin to understand that in the most ordinary situations, you have an opportunity to practice this degree of tenderness and empathy and compassion. Start with the people closest to you. Start with your friends. Start really forgiving your friends for their shadows, and start helping and understanding your friends and encouraging your friends and helping them to evolve in non-obtrusive, non-authoritarian ways by being there for them and offering whatever wisdom you have and whatever awakening you have to their growth. Love your partners. Realize that it's a sacred responsibility to have a wife or a husband. It's a sacred task to love in a noble way and shoulder the difficulties of that sacred responsibility and go for it, and you'll find that your relationships will be lit up with a secret light and become infinitely more profound and more beautiful and more nourishing. Come together in networks of grace, people of like-minded souls and hearts, and experience the glorious energy of synergy. What happens when a group of people, even if it's only six or seven people who have a true belief in the possibility of the future, true groundedness in God, come together and start plotting radiant mischief, what happens is there's a great outburst of creativity, a great outburst of love and meaning and purpose flood into all the lives of the people who participate. Experience that. Experience how sacred collaboration can lift your life and your work to a whole new level. Experience the extraordinary blessing of authentic relationship with animals. My life is a relatively solitary one because I live alone in a log cabin in Arkansas with two cats. I travel a lot and come back here for restoration and peace and normality. And my cats have revealed to me over the years just how unbelievably wise and beautiful and holy the creation is, and how extraordinarily psychically and spiritually awake animals are. Everybody who has a pet can experience this if they allow the sacredness of the relationship to flower, and it can give enormous help and calm and strength, as it has to me. So in all of those ways, we don't have to change the circumstances of our lives to enter into this new consciousness. We have to look at our lives in, with divine eyes, with illumined eyes, and enter into the intricacy of the relationships that are already with us with a wholly new attitude of compassion and encouragement and celebration. And if we do, we will be fed kinds of purpose and peace and passion and strength that we have absolutely no imagination of now. One of the things that I find repulsive about the New Age is that it never talks about any of these kinds of ways into the divine, and these are all the most important ways. This is the ways in which tribes have kept together through very great ordeals. This is the way in which the early Christians were able to survive the appalling massacres of the Romans. This is the way the Prophet began his great mission in Islam. This is the way in which it's always been done, and we must return to this. It makes every kind of holy sense.
What is true happiness, and is it even something people should strive for, or is it a trap that prevents them from discovering how to be content in life?
I am not interested in happiness myself. What I'm interested in is joy. I think joy is a far more profound emotion than happiness, because joy is a direct connection with the great bliss of the divine presence, the ananda, as the Hindus call it. I'm interested in living a life, however grueling and rugged and full of grief, that constantly opens me to the presence of the divine and so floods me with joy that can exist even in the middle of heartbreak and suffering. I think the pursuit of happiness is always endangered by narcissism, because the person who pursues happiness is probably an unenlightened person, so therefore interprets happiness in terms of goals that satisfy his or her ego, thus keeping alive a system of illusion that is now lethal. Go for joy. Go for the joy of selfless service. Go for the joy of direct connection with the divine, and you'll be fed with truth and strength, whatever terrors and horrors you have to face. That is the mystic's call. And I think it's time for the world to hear the call of the mystics, because they know that circumstances can shift and destroy any form of what you call happiness, but if you find your deathless divine consciousness and the joy that springs from its core effortlessly, then whatever happens and in whatever circumstances you find yourself, you can keep calm and keep praising and keep being fed by the Holy Spirit. And we've seen people who've done this in extreme circumstances. There are thousands of accounts of people in concentration camps who knew they were going to die, who did not go into paralysis or distraction or despair or fury, but grounded themselves and could find exquisite and lasting joy even in those horrible circumstances. I believe the world is being taken into a massive death camp, and that if we don't find that joy that death cannot destroy and disappointment and defeat cannot unravel, if we don't find that, we won't be able to survive. If we do find that, then we'll be able to go through whatever ordeals are this great evolutionary shift demands, even if it demands our extinction. We'll be able to go through that with a radiance that will be dignified and humane.
Just a few more questions. One has been a perplexing issue for a long time. Historically, we didn't have a lot of vehicles in the conservative or into the liberal communities to share the type of sacred spirituality that you are referring to. Instead, we had more of an existential, pragmatic, and a distance measured approach, almost fearing to have a program on spirituality. Lex Hickson, I don't know if you ever remember
Lex. Oh, I met Lex, yes. He was a great figure, a wild man.
Well, he had a wonderful program on WBAI.
Very, oh, really?
Very large audience. And I helped him with that program. And Lex and my programs were the two most listened to on WBAI at the time. And Lex was a renegade against many systems.
Yes.
He also,
well, a great master of their intricate esoteric knowledge. He was amazing.
You couldn't throw him a curveball, because
no.
I don't care what you threw him. He was able to ground it. But the stations, other producers, the culture of the rest of the station resented programs on spirituality. They thought it was naive. Most were agnostic or atheist. And even today, the vehicles that are available for people to talk about spirituality without connecting with a specific religion are few and far between.
Yes.
And so how do you look at those people who call themselves social activists and environmentalists and political activists and human rights activists, but completely negate to give any credit to the spiritual? Their polemic is always what they fall upon, never that anything may happen because of their spiritual values, and are holding in disdain those who hold such values.
Well, I think that's a wonderful question. It's one that I bump up against every single day. In some ways, the activist critique of spiritual people is accurate. Their critique of the ways in which religions often support the systems of cold evil rather than activate rebellions against them is accurate. Their critique of the baby boomer new age generation as being a group of orgiastic narcissists is accurate, but they have thrown the radiant baby out with the filthy bathwater and negate any kind of connection with spirit. Really are almost like Ronald Dworkins in their rejection of the divine at all. And that is their fatal mistake, because as you and I well know, most of the activist organizations that I've had any dealing with, and I've had dealing with many of them, are absolutely ravaged by egomaniacal conflicts and terrible inner dissension and endless arguments over vocabulary and stagings of massive diva outbreaks. And that means that they are horribly ineffective in the long run, and also cannot claim the kind of galvanizing moral high ground that a Gandhi or a Dalai Lama or a Martin Luther King could claim to rouse the people at large. And that means that they are essentially little groups of self-righteous, egomaniacal, power-drunk, Messiah complex, burnt out people who cannot work with the energies of the Spirit to sustain themselves or to elevate their message into an inspiring enough one to be able to unparalyze the masses. So it's a tremendous problem, but I'm pleased to say one thing, and that is that 10 years ago when I began my work with activists, there was unbelievable and very nasty resistance to any suggestion that a grounding in simple meditation beyond religion, a grounding in simple prayer practice beyond religion, a grounding in yoga beyond religion could be of any use to activists. They just thought this was liberal, sweetie-tweety rubbish. Now I'm seeing that more and more activist groups, as the crisis gets worse and worse, and as their solutions, often fairly decent ones, get more and more remote, to implement, they're seeing that they will not be able to go on unless they actually ground themselves in a source larger than themselves. And also, many activist groups are waking up to the necessity of healing the ego dynamics within the groups and are employing techniques of nonviolent communication, the wonderful work of Marshall Rosenberg, and other kinds of spiritually based techniques that they need to be able to heal their own wounds and the wounds of the kind of culture that they're protesting against to be effective. So there is a movement within the activist community to get more awake to the necessity of fusing spirituality and action in sacred activism, but it's still a small movement. And as you say, the hostility against spirituality, against any kind of recognition of a larger source or a larger plan, is still extreme.
Well, Andrew Harvey, thank you very much for all the good work, your new book, Radical Passion, the website andrewharvey.net. From the Ozark Mountains, I'm Gary Nall from our studio in New York City, a continuation of our spirituality series. Thank you all for listening.